are essentially Sushupti and Turiya. These two conditions are states of trance. One, a trance, both of them trances in which one loses contact with nature in different degrees. Now, what Sri Aurobindo is saying is a certain modification of this entire theory. It rests on this theory, but it illuminates this theory in a very interesting way. Because what he is pointing out is that by the power of the first of the three transformations, by the psychic transformation, particularly the power of the psychic aspiration, the wall between the unknown and the unknowable is pushed further. Now, we have to understand this. This is part of his theory of evolution. Evolution proceeds in a universal way in nature. But with the human being, evolution turns to a certain point which can be called the reversal of consciousness. Evolution of Prakriti becomes evolution of Purusha. Now, at this particular point, the concentration of the evolutionary process becoming individualized in the human being pushes the borders of nature's process to the extent that it is now in the hands of the human aspiration to move beyond the unknown. See? So for that, there has to arise in the individual an aspiration that sees the insufficiency of manifestation. This does not arise altogether universally in nature. One second, I think somebody is trying to beep me, or I'm not sure what. Wait a minute. What is happening here? Okay, I'm not sure if somebody is trying to send me a message. Okay. So this does not occur as a process of nature, but in an individualized form, in one or other or a number of beings, there may arise the aspiration for a condition of existence that goes beyond the natural manifestation. This is partly the reason why Sri Aurobindo and the mother state that the human individual is even greater than the cosmos, because the transcendent dwells in him. That is why the intuition of something going beyond the very possibilities of the unknown exist in the individual. Psychic aspiration can be mobilized to push the borders of the unknown into the unknowable, and in doing so, creating a rupture in which that which is necessary, a descent or intervention of a principle from the unknowable, can begin a new manifestation in the cosmos. This is the entire basis of what Sri Aurobindo's theory of evolution is pointing to at this point. Now, in this chapter, what we read, he is pointing to, in a very strong way, also the agency of the higher consciousness to intervene. He's saying without that intervention, it is not possible to undergo this particular transition. And we discussed that a little bit, what that means. Does that mean a choice of the spirit in terms of consciousness, in terms of an individual, that it missions, as it were, so as to create the bridge between the psychic and the transcendental, and including the cosmos in its upward ascent? Or is it just a rupture from above? Now, Sri Aurobindo does not make that clear in The Life Divine, but we discussed a little bit the role of the avatar in this process last time, as an individualized bridge between the aspiration of nature and the intervention of supernature. Now, over here, after that, in this chapter, Sri Aurobindo engages a very interesting discussion on fate and free will. What is the meaning of free will? Where does the sense of fatalism come from? And human beings' experience of free will, what does it imply? Firstly, the idea of free will comes into us because of two reasons. One is we are bound by the lower automatisms of Prakriti, which are imprisoning factors, the imprisoning factors of our own nature, but first felt by us as nature around us. It is as if the world creates circumstances which are imprisoning. If we delve into it, we find that not only the world, but ourselves have things in us which imprison us. Now, the other factor is the property of ego through which we experience ourselves. Property of ego is a separative property. Therefore, we experience ourselves as being separated from other beings, and hence sharing a certain kind of collective condition in which wills are tangled and in conflict. Therefore, free will is that which we move towards as something which gives us freedom from this entanglement of the cosmic situation. Sri Aurobindo points out that it is legitimate to seek freedom from the automatisms of Prakriti or of nature. This is part of our transition out of this condition of ignorance. This is part of the reason why we aspire because of nature. But he also points out that the exaggerated interest in free will also comes from a certain of freedom that rests on the ego. If we recognize that the ego itself is of ignorance, then we will understand that indeed freedom of will is something that is relative. Our will is bound under the automatisms of nature, of Prakriti, in a certain kind of lower nature. But our will is also bound to the cosmic will, which has set this evolutionary cosmos into motion, and in which the multiplicity of the manifestation is harmonized. No separate will can exist other than its recognition of its place in a harmonious manifestation or unfoldment. So, the recognition of the existence of the individual will in a cosmic harmony is the more mature becoming of free will. Now, in this transition, there is a movement out of nature or Prakriti to the action of a higher nature. And Sri Aurobindo points out that there are two ways in which this movement can take place, and both are certain ideas of fulfillment in the human being. And we discussed this last time in relation to the Gita and its notion of the two Purushas, Shara and Akshara Purusha. The Akshara Purusha seeks for freedom in something which is immutable. Ultimately, it unites with the cosmic Purusha. But in union with the cosmic Purusha, either its will can be completely put to sleep. Hello, can anybody hear me?
Yes, Devashista, we can hear you.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
I thought that it's I mean, okay. So either the union with the cosmic Purusha, in which its will can be put to sleep, or its will can continue in a prolonged way, whatever it has received as its upbringing and its inner formation of Prakriti, or it can become a channel for the cosmic will itself. On the other hand, as far as the Sharap Purusha is concerned, the dynamic part, the fulfillment of that lies in a surrender to this higher will of Paraprakriti, where it becomes an instrument of this higher will. So this is where we are. Sri Aurobindo has taken us through this journey and shows us that okay, shows us that to get to this point, there has to be a acquiescence of both Purusha and Prakriti to this higher will. This what we call the free will is ultimately an acquiescence to the humanized will of the real, what he calls the real idea, the supramental will that is behind this entire creation. So that not only the three stages, Sakya, cosmic and supramental, but that the Prakriti also evolves and it, in its evolution actively and willingly submits itself to a higher action of nature. Now, this second part is the most difficult part because even if we may conceive that the Purusha can enter into union with a higher Purusha, the Prakriti may still continue to act in its own way unless it develops a will within each of its parts that needs transformation. That willing aspiration for transformation has to come into every part of the Prakriti. This is why the surrender to Paraprakriti in the nature is a key aspect of this evolutionary process. And that is mediated by the first two forms of transformation. The psychic transformation brings in an aspiration into the nature because it is a transformation of nature under the impress of the psychic being. Transformation, an aspiration for this higher fulfillment. But the scope of that higher fulfillment is not even fully, possible to us until there is the union with the cosmic Purusha because the extent and problem of the cosmic manifestation is not fully experienced by us until there is the union with the cosmic Purusha. Therefore, that cosmicization of the being is another very important step that must happen. And the last paragraph that we read, Sri Aurobindo points to the difficulty of this transformation of the nature of because every part of the nature must give its willingness. And he points to two of the major difficulties in this process. One is that there are parts of the nature which are habitual. And the other is these are the parts closer to the material base, to the physical consciousness. And the other is there are parts of the nature that have developed a certain kind of will to remain what they are. Not just habitual, but a will to resist change, particularly to resist surrender to a higher principle, because their mistaken sense of free will, this very subjection to ego, is something that they don't want to give up. So that is the other great problem which is ingrained in the nature. It is not something which we mentally create, but various parts of our nature stand as stumbling blocks on the way and sabotage our... So this is where we stand at this point in our study. Sri Aurobindo ends the paragraph by saying, there must be then a conscious self-direction of the mental being in us towards this change, this substitution of supernature for the old nature. This conscious self-direction of the mental being is a certain key point, a key step by which the psychic has possessed the nature, the highest leader of the nature, being the mental being that has developed a will in it, a self-conscious self-direction, a will towards this change, this substitution of supernature for the old nature, this transcendence, the rule of conscious obedience to the higher truth of the spirit, the surrender of the whole being, second condition. So that is the next stage. The whole being must learn to surrender. In the second condition, it has to be accomplished slowly and with difficulty by the being itself before the supernatural transformation can become at all possible. So, psychic emergence, willing consent of the mental being and willing surrender of the entire being and all its parts are the yoga nature, which is absolutely necessary if that transition is to take place into the highest reaches of the cosmic being and of the transcendence of the supramental being.
Tabitha, can you hear me?
Sure, I can hear you, Shyam.
Yeah, so you were talking about the unknown, the unknowable, and the known. So these three limits, are they clear boundaries based on the evolutionary principle, or are they more abstract entities with no clear boundaries?
No, see, as I was trying to bring out, the known and the unknown have clear boundaries as far as nature is concerned. But to the human being, the boundary between the unknown and the unknown, the boundary between the unknown and the unknowable is meant to be pushed so that there is a certain, what needs to be brought into the nature, into the realm of knowledge.
I think we can't hear what you said. Just said, Vashishtha, your response to my question.
Okay, can you...
I can hear you, but we... Oops.
Welcome to the conference call, a service of www.freeconference.com. When you have entered your conference, please announce.
Hello?
Shyam, we've lost most people.
Yeah, I'm trying to add them back. I don't know, it's been a little not so nice today.
Vince also I called simultaneously, so it's great and cool. Maybe then it was your connection which is...
Maybe.
Because also I heard the Vashishtha perfectly when you said you couldn't hear. Both times I could hear him.
Oh, really? Okay. Maybe then it's my computer today, huh? Between the known, the unknown, and the... unknowable, and you were saying that in the Prakriti, the two are the known and the unknown have clear.
I think all three have clear defined limits to Prakriti. That is the condition of the division between Vidya and Avidya. See, and this is partly the reason why traditional darshana has considered this division to be final. It is almost as if it is the condition of manifestation itself. But here is one of the innovations of Sri Aurobindo, in that he points to Prakriti, but the human being has something in him that is where he says that the human, in a way, and that greatness arises from the fact that the evolution is an evolution of Purusha. Right, so I was continuing from there to bring to attention the fact that in this chapter, Sri Aurobindo pays more prominent heed to the intervention from above. But we also discussed the place of human agency in effecting this intervention. And I was pointing out that if we look at Savitri, he makes this much more clear over there. Because particularly in the canto called The Pursuit of the Unknowable, we find that the yogi king Ashwapati, when he is about to be erased at that border between the unknown and the unknowable, confronts the power of the Divine Mother arising out of the unknowable, the supramental Divine Mother, who has no place as yet in the creation, and he engages in dialogue with her. This engagement in dialogue with a power in the unknowable is itself an extremely mysterious thing, because it means that something is persists beyond the boundaries of the unknown and can actually persuade the intervention of this supernature. The intervention occurs. So this is exactly a way by which Sri Aurobindo points to this power of the psychic through yoga to push the boundaries between unknown and unknowable and bring about the intervention of the unknowable.
So, there was you're saying that in the past, what used to happen was, it was accepted that it was unknowable and there was no attempt to push this boundary. It was more of discovering the limits rather than crossing it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. How far back in the past is difficult to tell, but at least in the historical period of Indian darshana, there has been a recognition of a clear division between these three terms that you just talked about, the known, the unknown, and the unknowable, as if this is the very condition of manifestation. Now, on the other hand, if we look at Western traditions are marked by the hubris to overcome. This is the very stamp of Greek culture, for example, though they are also marked by a fatalism. It is as if this division is clearly demarcated there too. But man is doomed to attempt to push the boundaries, to attempt to fly close to the sun, even if it means the burning of the wings of wax. Even if it means pushing the stone up the hill time and again and making, seeing it fall back. Still, mm-hmm. This is the very meaning of being human, the exercise of will. Now, in Sri Aurobindo, we find a combination of these two features and an overcoming of the fatalism by introducing this idea of the will that can push the boundaries of the between the known and the unknown, the unknown and the unknowable, and engage a power out of the unknowable itself to effect an intervention, to erase the lines of the law.
Thank you, Vashistha. Bindu, would you like to read the next paragraph?
Sorry, I was on mute. Actually, can I just ask for a quick question or clarification?
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Sure.
It sounds that the unknowable is unknowable in the sense that it cannot be known through three dimensions of matter that we live in. Meaning, I guess what I see, and with the Greek mythology that you also referred to, I've just been wondering about this whole, what Shivana calls the vital part, where did the law of self-affirmation and desire? Because I feel we're at that point now, where we're at the hubris with our own economic barbarism, where we're trying to evolve, but not in the direction that Shivana is giving us. I just wanted to make that point.
Yeah, no doubt. You're absolutely right. I mean, each of these things can be seen at many levels. Power of will can, that's why this discussion on free will that we engaged last time is very key in this understanding. And as I was trying to point out, the roots of free will have some truth and some error to it. And this idea of the vital will, the will that is tainted by ego, certainly cannot take us beyond the boundaries of the unknown. And also, as far as the unknowable is concerned, at no stage can the unknowable be ever fully known. It will always remain unknowable in the sense that infinity cannot be finitized, however much sort of emerges out of it. So unknowable will remain infinitely unknowable, but more and more out of it will emerge into the unknown and the known. That is the whole idea of the evolution. But at a critical point in the evolution, it is no longer possible for nature to effect that process. It has to be a power which is greater than nature, which yet resides within it. And that is in the hearts of human beings, as the transcendent Purusha that has taken its lodging there.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Shall I read them?
Yeah.
Could I ask a question first?
Yeah, sure, Vince.
Yeah. What is the difference between unmanifest and the unknowable?
Well, in a very deep sense, it is the same. But, you know, one is we are talking in terms of the whole field of existence, either from the viewpoint of knowledge or from the viewpoint of action, of the expression of consciousness. When we talk about manifestation, it is the expression of consciousness we are talking about. When we talk about knowable and unknowable, it is knowledge that we are talking about. But essentially it is the same. But again, manifestation can be understood in a variety of ways. Either we can talk about, you know, manifestation which is invisible, that is the realm of the unknown. Manifestation that has not yet become even invisible, that is the realm of the unknowable. And manifestation that is visible or sensible, that is the realm of the waking world. So, in its absolute essence, they are the same. In the experience, they are the same. It is two different ways of looking at it, either from the view of knowledge or from the view of expression of consciousness.
Oh, thank you.
Sure.
Shall I read?
Sure.
It follows that the psychic and spiritual transformation must be far advanced, even as complete as may be, before there can be any beginning of the third and consummating supramental change. For it is only by this double transmutation that the self-will of the ignorance can be totally altered into a spiritual obedience to the removing truth and will of the greater consciousness of the infinite. A long, difficult stage of constant effort, energism, austerity of the personal will, tapasya, has ordinarily to be traversed before a more decisive stage can be reached, in which a state of self-giving of all the being to the Supreme Being and the Supreme Nature can become total and absolute. There has to be a preliminary stage of seeking an effort, the central offering of self-giving of the heart and soul and mind to the highest, and a later mediate stage of total conscious reliance on its greater power aiding the personal endeavor. That integral reliance again must grow into a final complete abandonment of oneself in every part and every movement to the working of the higher truth in the nature. The totality of this abandonment can come only if the psychic change has been complete or the spiritual transmission has reached a very high state of achievement. For it implies giving up by the mind of all its modes, ideas, mental formations, of all opinion, of all its habits of intellectual observation and judgment, to be replaced first by an intuitive, and then there's something blurred in the book here, and then by an overmind or supramental functioning which inaugurates the action of a direct truth consciousness, truth sight, truth discernment, a new consciousness which is in all its ways quite foreign to a mind's present nature. There is demanded too a similar giving up by the vital of its cherished desires, emotions, feelings, impulses, groups of sensations, forceful mechanism of action and reaction, to be replaced by a luminous, desireless, free and yet automatically self-determining force. The force of a centralized, universal and impersonal knowledge, power, delight, of which the life must become an instrument and an epiphany, but of which it has at present no inkling and no sense of its greater joy and strength for fulfillment. Our physical part has to give up its instincts, needs, blind conservative attachments, settled proofs of nature, its doubt and disbelief in all that is beyond itself, its faith in the inevitability of the fixed functionings of its physical mind, the physical life in the body, that they may be replaced by a new power which establishes its own greater law and functioning in form and force of matter. Even the inconscient and the subconscient have to become conscient in us, susceptible to the higher light, no longer obstructive to the fulfilling action of the consciousness force, but more and more a mold and lower basis of the spirit. These things cannot be done so long as either mind, life, or physical consciousness are the leading powers of being or have any dominance. The admissions of such a change can only be brought about by a full emergence of soul and inner being, the dominance of psychic and spiritual will, and a long working of the light and power on the parts of the being, a psychic and spiritual remolding of the whole nature.
So this is again a very powerful paragraph in which so much is carried, and it starts off by pointing out how it is absolutely necessary for the first two transformations to have progressed quite a bit, almost to have completed themselves before the supramental transformation becomes possible. Now, this applies whether we admit that the supermind is already active in earth nature now, or whether it is not active. Supramental action on human nature demands a certain ripeness or a stage of development, and that stage can only come when there is a complete receptivity of nature, a surrender of the nature to the action of the divine force or divine shakti. Now, that is prepared by these two earlier transformations. The first of them, the psychic transformation, can proceed to a certain extent individually. Psychic transformation proceeds on those parts of the nature that form the individual jiva's burden, you may say, the karmic constitution of the individual. But cosmic nature is not sufficiently addressed by the psychic transformation. It is only to the extent that the second transformation completes itself and the psychic being unites as a person with the cosmic being, that sufficient control over the processes of nature can be universalized in the individual. That makes the conditions ripe for the action of the divine shakti from the supermind. Now, in discussing this, Sri Aurobindo makes a very practical point right in the beginning. That point relates to the distinction that Sri Aurobindo also draws on from the words of Sri Ramakrishna between the two methods of surrender. One is what he calls the surrender of the baby cat and the surrender of the baby monkey. Surrender of the baby cat is what appears to be a passive surrender, but it is actually a very high stage of active surrender. It is active surrender that has reached a fulfillment where it is completely passive only to the action of the divine force. Now, the other one, the surrender of the monkey, is one in which there is a very strong individual component in clinging to the truth, in cleaving to the divine. See, now, Sri Aurobindo begins by pointing out that to expect the way of a cat is not possible until the first two forms of transformation are sufficiently advanced. Particularly, it is only when the psychic being has come to the front that one can even talk about the way of the cat to any realized degree. And then he points out these three stages in the surrender. The first in which there is a certain degree of surrender, a preliminary stage of seeking and effort with a central offering or self-giving of the heart and soul and mind to the highest. Now this is what Mother calls the conversion. Conversion is a point in the surrender where there seems to be a central part of the being that makes its offering to the divine. This is that much of the psychic being that has a sufficient amount of hold over the inner being. Inner mind, inner vital, inner physical part that has given itself sufficiently to the control or influence of the psychic being makes this surrender. This surrender then sustains the journey of the being because the divine shakti responds to this surrender. This is the beginning of the journey by which the higher force prepares us. And in that preparation, there is a gradual turning of more and more of the nature towards the divine. So this is the transition from the first to the second. And it is only when the second completes itself that there is a new status of the Purusha, a status of the Purusha in which it becomes purely a witness of the action of the higher Shakti in the nature. Now, the nature becomes completely surrendered and passive in an active way to the action of the divine Shakti. And these three stages that he touches on here are what he also elaborates in the record of yoga as the three stages of Dasyam. He uses the rather enigmatic phrases, primary Dasyam, secondary Dasyam, and tertiary Dasyam, for the three stages of Dasyam, or slavery, as he calls it, to the divine Shakti in the record. Now, in delineating this, he talks about two kinds of developments that take place. Firstly, faith, which has to be blind to start with because we don't know. But blind faith has a certain insecurity about it, see. Because human beings are marked by the need for knowledge. That's the reason why he's saying that first, it implies giving up by the mind of all its molds, ideas, mental formations, of all opinion, of all its habits of intellectual observation and judgment. But this in and of itself can actually open it to all kinds of superstitions and to all forms of error. So this has to be accompanied by a growing replacement of the mental activity by the activity of divine sight. So, first aspect of this replacement of the nature of the mind is through its conversion into an intuitive mentality, and then gradually a conversion from that towards greater and greater power of seeing, arising out of the ranges of cosmic mind leading to overmind and ultimately to the truth sight of supermind. Now, similarly, it has to operate a transition in the vital as well as in the physical. And in both these cases, the specific kinds of challenges of these forms of consciousness are what he brings out so forcefully over here. In the vital, just as in mind, it is a project of knowledge that must be accomplished. In the vital, it's a project of will that must be accomplished. And there he points out that there must be a giving up by the vital of its cherished desires, emotions, feelings, impulses, grooves of sensation, forceful mechanism of action and reaction. And in its place, there must come a luminous, desireless, free, and yet automatically self-determining force, the force of a centralized, universal and impersonal knowledge, power, delight, of which the life must become an instrument and an epiphany. And in passing, he points to the difficulty of this, which lies in the fact that until we get a taste of it, we have no taste for it. The vital is a being of taste. It is a being that goes for what gives it satisfaction. And until we have any knowledge of this in vital terms, the vital has no will towards it. That's why he says over here, but of which it has at present no inkling and no sense of its greater joy and strength for fulfillment. If that sense could come, and that sense can come, only to the extent, it's a double bind, to the extent of the surrender, that replacement can begin and the vital can begin feeling that particular aspect and the will to surrender more and more of its action. But that can happen, the beginning of that can happen as the vital opens itself to the psychic and as the psychic transformation proceeds. Similarly, he talks about the physical part, the problems there being instincts, needs, blind conservative attachments, settled grooves of nature, doubt and disbelief in all that is beyond itself, faith in the inevitability of the fixed functionings of the physical mind, the physical life and the body. These must be replaced by a new power which establishes its own greater law and functioning in form and force of matter. This is ultimately what leads to the power of the Sharira Chatushta, what he calls the Ashta Siddhis in the record of yoga, where there is mastery over the forces of physical nature. So it's important to see the end of that. And then, of course, he pushes it beyond into the inconscient and subconscient. And those are the parts that we're not even conscious of because they belong to the sunken parts of the consciousness. And he concludes again by pointing to the necessity of the psychic emergence as the very key, and also of the widening of the being into the spiritual nature. He says, these things cannot be done so long as either mind, life, or physical consciousness are the leading powers of being or have any dominance. The admission of such a change can only be brought about by a full emergence of the soul and inner being, the dominance of the psychic and spiritual will, and a long working of their light and soul power on the parts of the being, a psychic and spiritual remolding of the whole nature.
Devashish?
Yeah.
I have a question.
Sure.
Is the inconscient and subconscient a passive subliminal as well? Or the subliminal?
Yeah. And they're also parts of the subliminal. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Devajita, you were talking about how some parts of the being they can be made to aspire only when they get a taste of it.
Yeah, exactly. Particularly in the vital, because the vital is a being of sense and enjoyment. It has a certain kind of grasp which is vital, of the delight of things. And there, unless it can receive the lessons of this higher delight, it remains only, abstract to it. It remains, insipid because not real to it.
Yeah, so Devashita, what I was going to say was that, that's at the vital level, but even at the mental level and such, when we read Sri Aurobindo and when we have not experienced what he has, many times we are only building models in the head based on our intuition or based on our, some analogies that we can think of or some metaphors. So it's not really the case that you've had a taste of it, so to say, right? I mean, you may have had some experiences of which, so to say, you could have had a taste, but many other times when the copious amounts of writings, we may not have experienced much of it at all. So it may be like we are just building models, trying to relate to it, but which may have no basis on what he is actually meaning, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. That's always there. But the thing is that it's, again, only because there has been an opening, even as you call it, an intuitive opening to a certain kind of possibility. that the aspiration has arisen at all. So as he points out, you know, it is really the psychic influence at some plane of the being that makes us even want to take the step towards knowing about these things. Uh-huh. And then there may be a growing intuition which takes place in the inner mind. Essentially, the growth in consciousness again takes place in the subliminal. The links are built within us. And that is what sustains us. So initially there may not be a conscious or waking experience of the kinds of things that are being talked about, but still a gradual growth into the world of Swapna, the subliminal world of these various powers. So that is what brings the notion of intuition and what sustains the understanding. Now at the level of the vital, again, there has to be a growth into some degree of psychic openness, which brings its intuition. Ultimately, the whole growth is mediated by the power of intuition, not by the power of experience, because that comes much later. But intuition is like a memory of experience that already is present in us. Ultimately, intuition is the presence of the unknowable in the unknown.
Thank you, Vashishta. Sitaram, would you like to read the next one?
Yes.
Just to add that, actually what you're saying is got a really a very profound aspect to it, because this is the reason why, you see, for example, before Sri Aurobindo, this whole idea, this is a new idea, this idea of being able to overpass the boundaries of the ignorance. Is in some and establish it in a cosmic form in nature is a new idea. And as you point out, it could very well be taken, if you take it purely on a mental level, it could very well just be an idea, a speculative idea, a possibility with no real truth to it. It is exactly, at that level, that those who are agnostic to this whole idea dismiss it. They say, this is just like metaphysics. You know, Hegel created ideas of this kind, and today's world dismisses him because they say, he was just a speculative thinker. Now, the thing is that Sri Aurobindo would remain in that domain unless people wake up to some kind of a inspiration or light that gives them some access to that which is beyond just mental speculation. There is a light in the work that attracts us. That is that blind part, you know. So that's why, it is a double bind, but it is initiated by a certain psychic recognition that we feel at some subliminal level of our own being that draws us to it, that attracts us towards it. And that attraction causes an increasing sense of light to develop in the inner being, that, you know, is a certain development of understanding.
Thank you. So at one level, what you're saying is even that's the person who may not have that intuition at all, who doesn't have that faith at all, may not be attracted to such a thing at all in the first place. But even beyond that, a person may have a faith, even one may say a faith or a trust, but despite that, but in spite of that faith or the trust, it may be that, you know, the approach is wrong because you've built up a completely different reading into what he has written, you know.
Yes, absolutely. You're very right there. And that's partly the reason why there are two consequences of what you're saying. One consequence is that it's very necessary to proceed very cautiously, testing every step of the way, replacing understanding with experience. That's where this growth that he's talking about, a growth that has to move from the, arrogance of, ignorance, which is what the normal mentality is all about, from that to a certain tentative intuition, mm-hmm. and from that to a growing knowledge. Now, that transition has to occur. Otherwise, there is a certain point at which we are stuck,
mm-hmm.
and we are banding about these intuitive or these ignorant constructions in place of the truth. This is definitely a big problem.
Yeah.
And, one has to be very cautious about it. And then the other aspect of it is that it ultimately applies only to the individual at the inner level of experience. All these things, whatever Sri Aurobindo has said is part of his experience that he's stating for whoever wants to listen to it and follow in his footsteps to validate in their own lives. Now, if on the other hand, we immediately take it because of the amount of light that the inner being has responded to, we jump to the conclusion that this is truth because I feel so attracted by it, and let me therefore shove it down the throat of everybody else, mm-hmm. because this is the truth. That is the other problem which accompanies this thing. There must be two caveats to this entire study. They are these two that we just discussed. One is that it has to be taken as a door to individual growth, and it has to be a growth which constantly progresses through the replacement of lower forms of knowledge by higher forms of experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, Devashish. I remember reading some letters in which he says about reading into these experiences, to have a healthy skepticism every step of the way.
Yes, very true. That is part of the apparatus of this particular progress. That also, I think, is part of the apparatus of what he's calling tapasya. This whole thing about, it's all too well to just keep talking about surrender, we must surrender, etc., the way of the baby cat, etc. But as he brings out so clearly in this paragraph,
mm-hmm.
a large part of the way has to be mediated by tapasya. And it's a combination. It's these three forms of dasyam, as he spells out in the record of yoga. They have to transition, unless one is a Sri Ramakrishna who is born with, the consciousness of the baby cat, an avatar of the psychic being. Other than that, it has to be a transition that follows these steps. And what you call what he also calls the healthy skepticism is a very important component of that process of tapasya.
Yeah, and I think what you mentioned about the surrender is a very good example, because it's a pretty popular word, and in my experience, what somebody else means and feels when he or she says surrender may be completely different from what you or think it is, or what you practice or you think you're practicing as. So it's like very prone to this very
subjective,
prone, yeah, subjective,
subjective
inner
interpretation.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I think Mother's birthday message this year.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah.
It's very beautiful. It very much reads into whatever we are studying.
Yeah, I think. Sorry, go ahead.
Especially shoving down the other stroke part you just mentioned.
Yeah.
It is the path which is true only for you and practice for.
Exactly.
That was really not something that I am very much currently concerned about personally. There was just about the about preaching or that aspect. But for yourself too, that same problem applies, right?
Sure.
Yeah. That was the reason for my question more than the other.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. At the individual level, the same thing applies, and that's exactly the psychological process of self-doubt and growth into knowledge that has to have that component built into it.
Especially because, I mean, in many times, I think the mother also says that one cannot measure one's own growth because one is, in a way, you know, flying blind, so to say. So it's easy to get into these, in my experience, to get into these situations where you may be interpreting in a way or you may be thinking something, but what may be going on may be something that's unknown to even to you.
No doubt, no doubt. That's the case, in fact. I mean, that's mostly the case. And it's only, and as you say, mother points out that it's often in retrospect that one recognizes that one understands something. It is after the experience has established itself that suddenly it dawns on one that, oh, this is what it really means. Because, you know, we sometimes have intuitions or we have some constructions and we're going by that, but it's only when something really establishes itself that in retrospect one understands what it means.
Yeah, thank you, Devashista. Very useful. Shall we read the next one?
Sure.
The purification of the entire being by a breaking down of the wall between the inner and outer nature, a shifting of the position and concentration of the consciousness from the outer to the inner self, a firm foundation on this new basis, a habitual action from this inner self and its will and vision and an opening up of the individual into the cosmic consciousness is another necessary condition for the supramental change. It would be chimerical to hope that the supreme truth consciousness can establish itself in the narrow formulation of our surface mind and heart and life, however, turned towards spirituality. All the inner centers must have burst open and released into action their capacities. The psychic entity must be unveiled and in control. If this first change, establishing the being in the inner and larger, a yogi in place of an ordinary consciousness has not been done, the greater transmutation is impossible. Moreover, the individual must have sufficiently universalized himself. He must have recast his individual mind in the boundlessness of a cosmic mentality, enlarged and vivified his individual life into the intermediate sense and direct experience of the dynamic motion of the universal life, opened up the communications of his body with the forces of universal nature before he can be capable of a change which transcends the present cosmic formulation and lifts him beyond the lower hemisphere of universality into a consciousness belonging to its spiritual upper hemisphere. Besides, he must have already become aware of what is now to him superconscious. He must be already a being conscious of the higher spiritual life, power, knowledge, ananda, penetrated by descending influences, new made by a spiritual change. It is possible for the spiritual opening to take place and its action to proceed. before the psychic is far advanced or complete. For the spiritual influence from the above can awaken, assist and complete the psychic transmutation. All that is necessary is that there should be a sufficient stress of psychic entity for the spiritual higher overture to take place. But the third, the supramental change does not admit of any premature descent of the highest light, for it can only commence when the supramental force begins to act directly, and this it does not do if nature is not ready. For there is too great a disparity between the power of the supreme force and the capacity of the ordinary nature. The inferior nature would either be unable to bear, or bearing unable to respond, or receiving unable to assimilate. Till nature is ready, the supramental force has to act indirectly. It puts the intermediary powers of the overmind or intuition in front, or it works through a modification of itself to which the already half-transformed being can be wholly or partially responsive.
So here you see again he's making it very clear. In the previous one he put it in a little more philosophical language when he said that without the psychic and the spiritual change, the supermind or supramental shakti cannot act in us, or that change is not possible. Here he is saying or elaborating on the same in terms of the psychological conditions necessary. And again, the way in which he's putting it is related to a way in which he puts it in the synthesis of yoga, where he relates psychic emergence with another one, which is what he calls the development of the yogic consciousness. Development of the yogic consciousness is a becoming fully conscious of the inner being, of the inner field of consciousness. So here he relates it to all the centers of the being. Not only is it that mind and life and vital, mind and life and body have to change their centers of consciousness and enter within, as he's pointed out before, from mental prakriti, vital prakriti and physical prakriti as the motive factors of our becoming, we have to move into the inner being and identify with the mental purusha, vital purusha and physical purusha, and further move into the psychic being and bring that to the front as the true central being. If you remember earlier, in earlier chapter, last chapter, Sri Aurobindo discusses this whole idea of the central being. What is the central being? How do we have identity with the central being and replace the central being? It's the replacement of the central being that is one understanding of the triple transformation. So here again, he's bringing that to the front by pointing to the fact that there must be an opening up of the field of the inner being so that there is a full control of the consciousness and an opening up of its powers. The nature, not only the purusha, not only the central being, being the inner purushas, but also their prakritic actions moving out of the depths of their centers, which is the seven chakras, and emergence of the psychic being, these must all take place for the preliminary stage of the transformation. That constitutes, in fact, the psyche transformation. But this is not enough. And that's when he comes in and says that there has to be a universalization of the consciousness. Not sufficient for individual change and even opening up of the individual consciousness, but universalization of mental, vital and physical consciousness, because the supramental consciousness is a transcendent consciousness, the real idea behind the entire cosmos. And it is only to the extent that we can embody the cosmic being that we can prepare ourselves for the union with the supramental being and the supramental nature, particularly because that is the whole idea of the triple transformation. Now, in this process, he points out that so far as these two transformations are concerned, they may proceed simultaneously. They may proceed independently even. They may in fact complete each other through a kind of corresponding process. The whole of the Indian tradition has given a lot of emphasis on the development of the second of the three transformations. That is the cosmic realization and some degree of cosmic transformation as well. So that has not needed to rest on the psychic emergence of the psychic transformation. However, it couldn't have happened were there not some degree of psychic aspiration in some part of the being, usually the mind. Now, he points out that the psychic, in its emergence, may mobilize the development of the spiritual consciousness, of the cosmic consciousness. But both these must complete themselves. One must become fully psychicized and one must open up to the cosmic, not merely at the level of the mind, but mind, life and body must experience what it means to be the divine in the cosmic sense. Then the preparation is ready for the supramental action. But as these preparations are proceeding, supramental consciousness, because of the aspiration of the psychic, also begins to delegate certain types of processes. That's what he's talking about. His nature is ready. The supramental force has to act indirectly. These are the delegated possibilities. Just as we were talking about nature in its evolution, receiving into the subliminal certain influences from the higher planes, so do certain delegate actions in the inner being of supermind start occurring once there has been a sufficient amount of preparation through psychic and spiritual transformation. And that, he says, by putting the intermediary powers of overmind or intuition in front, or it works through a modification of itself to which the already half-transformed being can be wholly or partially responsive. So this is a kind of dumbing down, if you want to use that popular term, by the supermind to accommodate the growing consciousness of the individual. Now, there's another place where he talks about another aspect of the same process. Not only is the fullness of the supramental consciousness reduced in its delegation to the growth of the individual, but also its cosmicity is to some extent reduced. It talks about how the supermind individualizes itself to a certain degree to create what one might call an individual supermind that relates itself to the growing individual Purusha that has become cosmic enough. And also he talks about collective supermind. In other words, collective formulations of the supermind that exist to, you know, find expression in Gnostic collectives or Gnostic groups. as this development takes place, because it is so universal and so all-encompassing that the transition itself has to go through several stages, even beyond what we think of as the cosmic at our stage.
When we say that it is acting like even the supermind is acting in an individualized form, is that something that has just started happening, or is that something that was always active even earlier?
That is very difficult for me to say, Shyam.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
Sri Aurobindo talks about it, but my sense of it is that he's talking about even the Vedic rishis. It is not necessarily something that is happening only now, but something that has happened or that can happen only after a sufficient degree of preparation of the being takes place. Now, the individualized supermind, my sense is, again, now here is where, you know, exactly the danger that you were talking about comes in, because we are so far away from these things that we can only form, you know, very half-baked intuitions about them. But my sense is that, present sense at least, is that individualized supermind is exactly what is necessary, at any stage. I mean, not at a stage like today, but at any stage as the being prepares, the psychic and the cosmic transformations. That is what comes into play, leading towards the next stage.
Yeah, thank you, Debashis. I guess the question, I mean, yeah, thank you. Louis, would
you say, for example, Vedic rishis had contact with supermind. And this entire path that he's talking about has to some extent been hymned out in the Vedas. To what extent is difficult for us to say, but perhaps a large part of it has been foreseen in the Vedas. Now, yet it was not the time for that kind of manifestation to become universal. It was much ahead of its time. It was almost like the dawn of the idea that has to pass through the entire cycle of history to reach its culmination in a universal sense now. But for it to have even come into the consciousness of a few individuals, they needed to have gone through the steps of the process that led them into contact with some delegated power of the supermind that must have been individual.
Yeah, I guess without appropriate, experiences, it's more we get into the field of speculation here, right?
Yeah, true.
Louise, will you read the next one?
Spiritual evolution obeys the logic of a successive unfolding. It can take a new decisive main step only when the previous main step has been sufficiently conquered, even if certain minor stages can be swallowed up or leaped over by rapid and brusque ascension. The consciousness has to turn back to assure itself that the ground passed over is securely annexed to the new condition. It is true that the conquest of the spirit supposes the execution in one life or a few lives of a process that in the ordinary course of nature would involve a slow and uncertain procedure of centuries or even of millenniums, but this is a question of the speed with which the steps are traversed. A greater or concentrated speed does not eliminate the steps themselves or the necessity of their successive surmounting. The increased rapidity is possible only because the conscious participation of the inner being is there, and the power of supernature is already at work in the half-transformed lower nature, so that the steps which would otherwise have had to be taken tentatively in the night of inconscience or ignorance can now be taken in an increasing light and power of knowledge. The first obscure material movement of the evolutionary force is marked by an aeonic graduality. The movement of life progress proceeds slowly, but still with a quicker step. It is concentrated into the figure of millenniums. Mind can still further compress the tardy leisureliness of time and make long paces of the centuries. But when the conscious spirit intervenes, a supremely concentrated pace of evolutionary swiftness becomes possible. Still, an involved rapidity of the evolutionary course swallowing up the stages can only come in when the power of the conscious spirit has prepared the field and the supramental force has begun to use its direct influence. All nature's transformations do indeed wear the appearance of a miracle. But it is a miracle with a method. Her largest strides are taken over on assured ground. Her swiftest leaps are from a base that gives security and certainty to the evolutionary saltus. A secret, all wisdom governs everything in her, even the steps and processes that seem to be most unaccountable.
Vasudha, you may be muted.
Oh, am I? Can you hear me now? Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yes,
now.
I can hear you.
Oh, okay. I guess I was unmuted before and I muted myself now. So, I was saying that here he is pointing to the necessity of a certain progression which must be followed in the stages of growth, you know, of consciousness. And even if there is a rapid movement, yet that does not change the fact that the stages have to be accomplished. And it's a very interesting passage for a number of reasons. One is that there might be, you know, elsewhere he points out that nature sometimes over times when individuals may enter into certain conditions of consciousness that completely break the link with nature. But if that happens, that's only a certain preliminary kind of scouting of the territory. But later there has to be a bridge built between the present condition of nature and whatever was achieved. That same thing he's pointing out over here too, in fact that eventually every nook and cranny that has been left unbridged must be bridged. There has to be a continuum of consciousness. That continuum of consciousness is part of the entire method and intent of nature, and human beings follow that particular journey in establishing all these links. Now, the other very interesting thing about this paragraph is the description he gives to the idea of progress. this description to the idea of progress to some extent was quite prominent at the time when Sri Aurobindo was writing this, and much before it, in fact, as part of the 19th century image of progress, of human progress, or of progress in general. And this is, it continues in our time as the anthropological notion of the exponential growth of capacity in nature. So here he is, though this is usually applied to the human in terms of seeing how it took a very long time for primitive man to move from a condition of hunters and food gatherers to a condition of settled agrarian life or the taming of livestock. And, from that to, the use of stone tools, ultimately the technologies of, the Bronze Age and the Iron Age and of urban dwelling, this kind of a process has been an exponential process. It has taken very long in the early stages of human development, and it's accelerated to a tremendous degree as we move through the ages, through the years. But this particular description that we see in natural history museums, for example, is coded completely in terms of technology, man's tool-making capacity. What Sri Aurobindo is doing is extrapolating it both ways. Firstly, in the direction of nature, that is, in the emergence of life in nature, from a pre, vital manifestation of matter, to the emergence of life in nature and the emergence of mind in life and their manifestations, their respective manifestations, there is the same kind of exponential sort of development. And when we come to the expressions of mind in humanity, there again, we can, sort of relate it to this notion of the rapid development of human mastery over the world through the use of mind. But this has not eventually really changed the human being as such. Human consciousness has remained what it was, except in the ability to exercise what it already has. In those terms, what has evolved is more nature than the human being. Nature in its various forms of consciousness has manifested or expressed itself in an exponential advance. But human being is only today at a point where you can think about evolution of the human consciousness. That has to be accomplished consciously through the power of consciousness itself. And that is what he's pointing to here, that we can think of this reversal of consciousness concentrating the whole effort of nature to a much greater extent than whatever it has done, even though it has proceeded along these exponential lines. But even if we do that, we have to think of it in terms that are gradual and that are in some sense exhaustive, that cannot afford to leave behind any part of the territory in the sort of development of totality of progress to supernature.
Devashish, isn't something's out of balance now, whereas the technology, the use of tools has increased so much, leaving man's consciousness behind, so to speak? It's like the technology is so developed, the nature is so developed now that one feels left out.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, that's exactly, you're right, Vince. That's exactly where we have to recognize that this, again, we were talking about hubris, that human hubris, particularly perhaps arising out of a certain, understanding of what it means to be human, has led us in a direction which has left human consciousness behind. And human consciousness has not evolved. While there is a sense that human ability to master nature has evolved, but that is not necessarily human consciousness, you see. That is only an aspect of human consciousness, which is ultimately just one of the powers of nature. It is as if we have instrumentalized mental nature while considering it to be the essence of human consciousness.
Very well said.
Yeah. Hey, can you be a little louder? I can't hear you.
I'm sorry. Actually, I had to come to an internet cafe. I was wondering at what point can we talk about a reversal of consciousness, crucial consciousness.
I could hear you, Bindu, so let me repeat what you said, and all you need to tell us is whether what I'm saying is right or not. Your question is, at what point at what point can we talk about consciousness?
Right, yeah.
Is it only when the psychic being emerges? Or is it at some other stage of development?
Yeah, I was basically thinking of the development of mind that we call it now. Is it part of the reversal of consciousness or no? But yes, you got the question,
right? Yeah, my understanding of this, Midhu, is that reversal of consciousness begins only when there is a certain degree of of entry into the inner being and possession or identification with the Purusha. Expression of the mind is not reversal of consciousness. Psychic emergence is true reversal of consciousness, but reversal of consciousness can be thought of before that, even with the development of the yogi consciousness. If there is identification with mental Purusha, it is the beginning of the reversal of consciousness, or with any of the Purushas for that matter.
Thank you, Devasita.
So isn't it the case, Devasita, by definition, any growth that the human consciousness, if any growth of the human experience can be said as it's only the ability to experience that consciousness has changed and not the fundamental consciousness itself. Like, how does one say the two are different?
Yeah, one can say the two are, that's why the whole idea of reversal of consciousness, your question is related to Bindu's, because idea of reversal of consciousness, idea of human consciousness, of individual consciousness, only begins when there is a certain kind of emergence of the person. You see, is there evolution of the person or of the idea of the person that is taking place? That is reversal of consciousness. Reversal of consciousness occurs when what we call the anthropic principle, of course, anthropic principle is related to the universal idea of the human, but at the individual level, the person, the human person, is something that gets a handle of itself as a form of consciousness. It's no longer a form of nature that is evolving, but a being that is taking the forms or taking the aspects of nature and evolving by itself. So, idea of individual or the human consciousness evolving is related to the transition from the universal yoga of Prakriti to the individual yoga of the Purusha.
Thank you, Devashishtha.
This is, in fact, you know, this question, actually related to this question, is one of the surprising features of what we call human progress in the modern age. You see, in modern age, and the whole idea was that mind will reach us to a point where we'll achieve a certain kind of godhood. And we have achieved a certain degree of godhood, if you want to call it that. But the problem is the individual has been completely anonymized in the process. See, that's exactly where we see in stark contrast this idea of the difference between the evolution of human consciousness and the evolution of the powers of nature. We have become instrumental in the evolution of the power, mental power of nature. But in power of consciousness, we have been anonymized. The human individual has become insignificant.
Yeah, yeah. And you are saying that, so that is kind of an indication or proof that it is not the right reversal that has happened. So there was the, were you saying that that's the reason we know that this reversal is not the correct reversal that has happened? The fact that the individual consciousness has been anonymized. So that's a hint to us that this is not what was meant to be, so to say.
Yeah, not that it is not the correct reversal, it is no reversal at all. You know, the reversal has not even begun.
Okay, but, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all that has happened is that human consciousness has been yoked. When we talk about yoga, you know, we talk about yoking of individual consciousness to a higher consciousness. Here we may say the human consciousness has been yoked to the purposes of a mental nature. Mental nature has progressed, but reversal of consciousness implies progress in the concept or in the development of sense of being individual, of being a person, Purusha.
Yeah, thank you, Devashishtha.
So, you know, when we talk about the modern age and the idea of godhood, you know, we do find that we've achieved a certain kind of, omnipotence. But this is the omnipotence of mental nature, anonymous mental nature. See, we have, an omnipresence. We talk about non-locality and things of that kind, you know. I mean, here we are... sort of gathered together by this power of telecommunication, so distant in physical terms, but this has been mediated by a power which belongs to anonymous progress of the mind. As far as individuals are concerned, none of us is individually capable of encompassing the whole world and contacting anybody else by the power of individual consciousness.
Yeah.
And yet, that is godhood. That is the Purusha. That is what the divine being is. See?
Yeah.
As a person.
So, I mean... with our limited vision, seeing the state of things as they are, the way you say it, right? How the individual has been anonymized, it's very difficult to comprehend how that can be reversed, you know, because it seems that that anonymity has such a, you know, such a grasp on the world and the world affairs, etc. today, that it's very hard to comprehend. It was very hard to comprehend how that can be reversed.
Yeah, you're right. And that is one of the big problems of the modern age, which is its tremendous ubiquitous hold on humanity. You see, that's why a lot of modern philosophers talk of this age as in a sense a totalitarian age. Mm-hmm. It is not as if some individual is establishing a totalitarian dictatorship for mankind, but it is as if the age itself mm-hmm. is determining the lives of men in a certain totalitarian way, much more than ever before, mm-hmm. even in its sense of choice. It's as if we're given multiplicity of choices, but these are our cosmetic choices. You know,
which only adds to the hypocrisy.
To the permutations of choice.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, the first step, and you're very right, it's almost impossible to even think of how one can get out of the stranglehold. And those who try, they end up becoming various kinds of, you know, agents of fundamentalism and destruction of various singular kinds. Now, what is the solution? The solution basically is first to understand that this is not the omniscience for which we are destined, that this has to arise in individuals first, because ultimately this is a reversal that is individual. It is the emergence of the individual, and hence it has to arise as perception first. It has to arise as faith in the individual first. And then out of that comes the reversal. The reversal ultimately is a reversal of omniscience in the individual. It's the faith that an individual can actually stand against, be pitted against this tremendous universal formation.
Yeah, thank you. That was just very appropriate.
Yeah, this is really the enigma of Sri Aurobindo and the mother, you know, seated in a little corner of the earth, having the power to and the destiny of the earth.
Yeah, and as you say, if any attempt is made, by almost by definition, it becomes, you know, fundamentalist and over-radical, correct?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if it is an attempt that is which pits itself antagonistically against the pervasive, you know, determining forces of modernity, it tends to become that. But on the other hand, if it is the reversal of consciousness, then it proceeds from an inward direction to enter into a power of relationship and mastery over the forces of nature.
Yeah. Because on one hand, we read about these things like knowledge by identity or to be able to identify with the other personas. And on the other hand, what you see is the complete extreme of, you know, individuality gone the other direction, right? Like completely opposite of what one would think is identification. More of, more and more individuality doing the opposite, right?
Yeah, true.
So if there are no other questions or comments, shall we stop for today and continue next week?
Sure.
Let's stop with a brief meditation.